Well, good morning. Welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. We welcome people from all religious, racial, and ethnic backgrounds and all sexual orientations. We are a lay-led congregation, and I am Erin Bosch, the current president. We will have Judith light our chalice this morning, after which we will have 1 minute of silent meditation.
You might recall that last week I lit the chalice in honor of scientists, and this week it's in honor of religious leaders, and this is a story that is told by the Jewish physicist Victor Weisskopf. In a Jewish theological seminar, there was an hours-long, maybe even a days-long discussion about proofs of the existence of God. After quite a long time, one rabbi got up and said, "God is so great, he does not even need to exist." It's nice to see you again, and it's especially nice to see how well the children's stories and the hymns fit with the scene, both last week and this week, because I couldn't imagine what kind of children's stories would come up. If you were here last week, you know that I read poems that were grew out of some reading that I had done of popularized science books and a residency that I had in Taos, New Mexico last fall, summer and fall, for 3 months. I call it the Reason Unreason Project, Reason/Unreason Project, and I was working on combining images of place and things that happened to me with thoughts about science and about spirituality. And last week I was using the poems that were, or I read to you some of the poems that were not so much about science, but had science as the controlling metaphor. And this week, the poems that have spirituality, also one prose piece that has spirituality as sort of a controlling metaphor. The chalice lighting in honor of religious leaders, religious and spiritual leaders, is again kind of an apology, because this week some of the poems reflect on the limitations of unreason. Also, some of them begin to present my own take on spirituality and religion. And I thought I'd start with a poem called The Miracle. This is something that actually happened to me. Miracle. It's all so easily explained how it slipped from someone's wallet, ripped nylon or leather stretched with wear, and lay unnoticed on the asphalt while he drove off to fill the tank with gas before a stop at the grocery store, so that when I pull into his empty space in the Walmart parking lot, thinking how I'm so focused on reason, it's time to consider faith, and trying to remember everything on my Saturday list, vitamin C, 1,000-milligram tablets, sunglasses, polarized max UV protection, vitamins, especially for mature adults, I open the door and find it, a blue and white striped card the size of my driver's license. Credit for heaven, it says. And if you want to see this card, I still have it in my wallet, so I can show it to you afterwards. New Mexico, as most of you probably know, is kind of a place full of spiritual seekers, and this following poem is actually a found poem. All of the lines were found in some of the brochures in a brochure rack at a Santa Fe motel. It's called, and this is one of the lines, "The Best Readings for Your Life." Friends can advise you, numerology directs you. I take your birth and arrive at the reason your soul chose to come to classroom Earth. Multi-incarnational sessions open a direct dialogue between you and your higher self. Clear a path to exquisite feelings of oneness that can only emanate from your soul. Call for business, financial, and legal matters, relationships, spiritual development. Channel and life coach, authentic psychic, spiritual teacher of global stature. Credit cards welcome Visa, MasterCard, and Discover. access the hologram of your soul. I discovered that public radio is a little bit different in Taos than it is in Wisconsin. This poem is called Truth and Consequences. At 9:06 a.m., the cosmic pilot presents the astrology forecast, coda to the NPR news. It's not at all upbeat. The moon's in a dire house, and Venus will trick you into romance that starts like heaven, but sours rapidly. Tonight will be bad for emotions. Stay home and read a book. Focus this morning, 10 to noon, on something that needs close attention. Balance your checkbook. Write a poem, lest some aspect of planets conspires to scramble your brain. It's all so much baloney, but what can I do about the price of a barrel of crude, hostages in the Philippines, the horse race they call fall elections? And who am I to diss the cosmic pilot? I don't harbor romantic illusions. I've already made evening plans, but the little hands pushing 10, I set aside my science books, the New York Times, the Nation, pull out a ruled yellow tablet, and start scribbling down these lines. And I think in a way that poetry for me is it's a way to access emotions, and it's also a way to access, it's sort of a spiritual practice. It's at least as hard to do as meditation, for me anyway. One of the things that I did, that I wanted to do when I went to Santa Fe, or to Taos, one of the reasons that I was interested in going there is the sort of confluence of spiritual practices and traditions. Of course, the Pueblo culture is old and still practiced, and I was fortunate to be there at a time when the Taos Pueblo had one of its San Geronimo feast day, which involved probably the most hair-raising thing I've ever seen, but they erect a huge pole. I mean, they must go out to the forest and find the biggest tree that they can possibly find, and they strip the bark and they sink it fairly deep into the center of the bare space where the Pueblo is, so that standing there like a gigantic, I mean really, really huge telephone pole, much higher than the telephone pole. And then the clowns come out, and there's all sorts of clowning around. And they, and then the clowns, the young men, at the top of the pole there is a dead sheep and some bags of food. And the idea is to get up to the top and then get the bag down, and they take it to the kiva. I guess, you know, this is in the fall, and this is sort of preparation food for the winter. They don't, the Pueblo cultures will not share what their practices are, so it's sort of a guess. But the clowns try to climb the pole, and finally one young man does, and gets to the top of the pole, and does a dance on the top of the pole, which, you know, couldn't be a whole lot bigger than that in diameter. And I was there with my younger son, who had come to visit me. And after he dances on the top of a pole for much longer than you want him to, he then sort of sits down on a crossbar that they have, and he lowers down the sheep, and he lowers down the food, and they get taken. And then you think, my God, he hasn't fallen, and he's going to come down. But he doesn't come down. He goes back up to the top, and he dances some more. And all I could think of was that this guy's mother was probably standing there watching him. And it was really scary. Another thing that I did, because the Catholic culture is also very strong, and the penitente culture, which is the people who go to, during Holy Week, they go to El Santuario de Chimayo, where there's Holy Earth. And I wasn't there, I was there 6 months ago. Months ago, so it was Labor Day weekend that I went to Mass at the outdoor chapel, because the church itself is too small to deal with the hordes of tourists that come. And this is a prose piece, a short prose piece called Mass at the Outdoor Chapel, El Santuario de Chimayo. Who is the woman two rows ahead, her blouse stretched across her black back, her dark hair short and ragged? From her compact torso, the deep tan of her arms, I take her to be Hispanic. I see she is a believer. She sways and nods, affirms the sermon, the hymns, the prayers, the blessings of the priest. I give her the name Maria. We sit in a semicircle facing the modest altar. Huge cottonwoods shield our granite benches from the desert sun. All around, homemade crosses, crucifixes carried by pilgrims to place at this sacred site. They ring the shaded enclosure, thin twigs tied with twine, rough sticks of salvaged lumber, leaning on strands of wire that fence off the parking lot, crosses propped against cottonwood trunks. Above us, a dangling crucifix hanging from a branch. Maria sits with a friend. Around her, tourists fill the pews, Filipino women, Japanese with cameras, Anglo teens in shorts and tank tops, a booted Texan who has not doffed his cowboy hat. Hispanic families from Albuquerque, Taos, Santa Fe. Maria is a tourist too, but from her body language, the way she sways and nods agreement with the priest, I see she is devout. Buenos dias. The priest welcomes us in Spanish and switches to accented English. He is Castilian, and in his sermon, he is careful to let us know. If I say I love you and I slap you in the face, maybe you say, Father, why do you slap me, Is that how you in Spain show love? Maria nods and sways. Later, the priest lisps his way in Spanish through the prayers for the dead. Everyone knows why he sounds like a foreigner. The service holds no magic. Holy Week and its pilgrim procession are half a year away. To my unbeliever's eye, only communion, body and blood from wafer and wine, hints of miracle. The newsprint Missalette delivers this week's lesson. It concerns faith and law, the Catholic credo, the importance of words and deeds. The priest describes the early Jews who, although they paid lip service to thousands of laws, has obeyed the Ten Commandments. The sins of these Jews upset him so much that he loses his English numbers. 5,200 laws, he says. And then, no, 2,500, 2,500. Maria sways and nods. But it's not just Jews the priest condemns. He has little use for Christians who don't express faith through acts, who merely give voice to belief. Maria nods and sways. The priest doesn't mention Muslims, much less Buddhists, Hindus, or Jains. The priest does not advocate holy war. He does not speak of inquisition. He preaches compassion and love. Holy, 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 he intones as communion nears. Maria sways and nods. Under my breath, I recite the ancient Jewish prayer, Kadosh, 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 I chant, bowing slightly on the waist. Maria rises to take communion. She is no common tourist. Not for her the trappings of pilgrimage, not for her the gift shop souvenirs, El Santuario mugs, plastic souvenirs, plastic saviors, Our Lady of Guadalupe jigsaw puzzles, St. Anthony visor clips. After Mass, she shuffles along the line of tourists to El Pozito, the hole full of miraculous earth. She watches the others spoon the dirt into film cans, into Ziploc plastic bags. She kneels, takes a pinch of healing earth, touches it to her lips. She waits for the miracle. Through the Jewish High Holy Days, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. And on Yom Kippur, I wrote this poem, I started this poem anyway, called Yom Kippur Fast in Taos, which you may know one is supposed to fast all day on Yom Kippur. And the evening before Yom Kippur, there's a service that's called the Kol Nidre service, which is actually one of the most beautiful services, as far as I'm concerned, is a chant, the Kol Nidre chant, which is gives me chills even thinking about it. Yom Kippur fast in Taos. Perhaps, says the rabbi after Kol Nidre, we fast to be more like angels. Perhaps, I think, just past noon the next day. Do angels get headaches because they don't eat? Do they shiver at their computers, chilled near to death by two missed meals, a weekend of clouds, the thinly veiled threat of snow? Do visiting angels in foreign lands shun Yom Kippur Torah service, not wanting to daven familiar prayers set to peculiar tunes? I punch up the thermostat. Still, I can't get warm. I dress for a walk outside. No diaphanous gown, no wings. I pull on woolen gloves, a sweatshirt over a turtleneck, a lined nylon windbreaker jacket. In a few blocks, blood starts to flow. The headache begins to diffuse. A breeze herds clouds like sheep. They flock against Taos Mountain. The sun breaks through. I shed jacket and gloves. When angels take walks, it's like this. Small birds sing from the power lines. The orchards are gifted with apples. The spice of a rain-soaked meadow sharpens the wood smoke air. Old blessings drip from the cottonwoods. Plastic flamingos strut in a cactus garden. Patches of blue sky promise tomorrow the mountaintop will be revealed. The next two poems, I guess, are maybe sort of the last the next three poems that are female poems, are about death. And actually, this one, which is called Barella's Death Card, is just an image of a sculpture, a large sculpture, well, that big, in the Harwood Museum in Taos. And it was made in the 1930s by a sculptor, you might call a primitivist, I guess, called Barella. Chiseled eyes, so deep the sockets swallow the unbeliever, Doña Sebastiana, death personified, waits in her three-wheeled cart. The shade of a former life tints a rear wheel green beneath some scraped brown paint. Rusty nail heads pock one board, stained by water, flawed by worms that tunneled its living tree. La Muerte, hewn from a single trunk, toddler-sized, from bullet head to broad feet planted firm on salvaged 1x4s, sits on the canted slab Barella planed for comfort. Her broad hips, strong thighs and fleshy arms, nearing 7 decades, crack curved along the grain. Cheeks bulge above her toothy, incised grin. A backbent penitente, present in his absence, starts to drag the cart uphill. He groans and sighs. Doña Sebastiana stares ahead. She relishes. The person I bought my house from 15 years ago just put planks of plywood on the windowsill, so they're broad, they're wide windowsills, not really wide windowsills, and I think that all the plants are going to fall off one day when the nails get loose. But I keep stuff on the windowsill, little things that appeal to me, and for years I've had this little collection of things that all sort of resonated in some way because they had the same pattern. And I was dusting them before a party this last December when this poem occurred to me. It's called The Pattern Recurs on my windowsill. think it's suitable for. St. Patrick's Day, the day after, too, because of the first image. The pattern recurs on my windowsill, where a postcard pictures the fractured rock of the Giant's Causeway, North Antrim, pentagonal pillars cobbled to walk by the waves of Loch Neagh, where the pitted face of a fist-sized stone picked up on a beach somewhere harbors a tiny clamshell caught in a deep recess, where the fibrous remains of a cholla, honeycomb empty and fragile, circle an absence of spines, where fossil marks, rows of ridged ovals, tile a sandstone slice with the ghost of animals, plants, ripples of waves, maybe the wind in the dunes, wind like the shifting air, sifting dust through the sunlight onto the dining room sill, dust motes rising and falling, dust dancing the shape of breath. And the last poem that I'm going to read is actually the most recent one I have written. I wrote it last week before last, I guess. It was a way of dealing with my anxiety over something I was expecting to come in the mail. And it's called Coping with Predestination. Somewhere, these things are determined, the job, the illness, the prize. One day, they are revealed. Email arrives, the telephone rings, a letter shows up in the box. The next step comes clear. Don't buy a ticket, check into the clinic, shop for a suit. Gods are beside the point. These things are ordered. Stops on the subway, lymph nodes in sequence, angst before answer. What works? Boxes of thin mints? Willful detachment? Faith. Closing words, Judith. I actually have closing words from two people, thoughts from a science writer and from a scientist. You may have seen, some of you, Natalie Angier's article in the New York Times Magazine, I think in January, about being proud to be an atheist, and these are her words. I don't believe in God, gods, godlets, or any sort of higher power beyond the universe itself, which seems quite high and powerful enough to me. I don't believe in life after death, chat rooms with the dead, reincarnation, telekinesis, or any miracles, but the miracle of life and consciousness, which again strike me as miracles and merely obscene abundance. I'm convinced that the world as we see it was shaped by the again genuinely miraculous, let's even say transcendent, hand of evolution through natural selection. And in counterpoint, a quotation from biologist E.L. Wilson, the human mind evolved to believe in the God. It did not evolve